This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, this is Finding the Funny and I'm Ezra Zayed. Finding the Funny is where we'll be speaking to and speaking about people who are in this funny business of entertainment and comedy. So be it stand-up comics, writers, hosts, actors and beyond, we'll be discussing everything from their work, their inspirations and what decisions and relationships impacted their craft.
We would have started earlier, but it's Malaysia, so you had to take a break in between laughter. This country, I can't even stay awake. It's like peaceful and relaxing. It's something in the air. I'm losing my anger. It's just like, shh, lay down. Welcome to Malaysia. Shh, yes, you are hot. Walk slower. I'm like, fuck. I'm an American!
My guest tonight is Butch Bradley. Raised in Atlantic City, he has become one of the more popular stand-up comics on today's comedy circuit. His experience has given him opening spots for the likes of Ray Romano, Lewis Black, and Dane Cook. And while he's a regular at such iconic American comedy venues like the Laugh Factory, the Improv, the Comedy Store, that's not all, as he has made it a point to perform extensively here in Asia, everywhere from Shanghai, Singapore, and right here in Kuala Lumpur. But for Bradley, it all started in Atlantic City.
I grew up in Atlantic City, and we were the second state in the United States, New Jersey, to have casinos. So my mother went from, you know, a waitressing job to working in this giant casino where all these entertainers were, Sinatra and Rodney Dangerfield. And I was a little kid, and my mom was pretty, you know, open, and she wanted me to see entertainment. So I was going at a very young age to watch these comedians perform, and I would watch these audiences just laugh, and I was like, this is incredible. I don't even know what's happening, but I want to do this. So it got deep into my, you know, blood. And then years later, I just, you know, was sick of my day job, and I thought, you know, I could get a job I don't like. Why don't I try doing something I really enjoy and give it a shot? And lucky for me, it's worked out. But I watch guys like Chappelle. Chappelle will blow me away. I watch him. I'm lucky to be in a room or to watch a young guy here. You know, I watch Rizal here, and I watched him last night.
Rizal Van Gazel.
Yeah, and getting to watch him a year later, still a new comic, and go, wow, cool. Watch him open up, work the crowd, look so loose and comfortable, address some local comedy, and then address some higher comedy that's about him and share it, and then get laughs. And another gentleman just came in from India who I never saw, you know, and I just did that Singapore Fest. So I'm working with guys from Australia, from England, from everywhere in the world, and I'm just getting little, wow, how cool, and, you know, little things that they show you, you know, and then, you have to watch, but you also have to watch people above your level, so it's nice that all levels will show you something, a spark or a moment that you can take into your own set.
You're actually sort of very much involved in this new wave of stand-up comedy happening, not just in Southeast Asia, but in Asia as well. And how interesting is that? Because, you know, it almost seems that you've had two lives almost.
That's really a great question, because that's what it feels like. And it's a little bit like time travel, because I heard all of these stories from the older comics who told me when comedy started in the 80s and the 70s and what they were going through. And then I did spend about 10 months in Shanghai helping the scene in China. And I was like watching these stories unfold, these young people, like the guy that just worked at the bar and thought, I always want to try comedy. And I'm like, this is incredible. And then, you know, 3 months later, seeing these guys. Or an example, I just did the Singapore Comedy Festival, and I have been lucky enough to see work with some of these guys in Indonesia before or in Malaysia before. And now I see them, and I go, oh, my gosh, look how good that guy. He's in front of 500 people in a theater, and he is crushing. It's incredible. It's really cool. I think it's only going to get even bigger. I really do. I think in the next, you know, 2 to 3, 4 years, it's just going to pop right in Malaysia. That club is going to have a line down the block. And also, you know, it's just a freedom. You know, they get up, they speak about their day, they speak about their life. It's such a healthy, wonderful thing. And then have an audience laugh and, you know, connect and sort of go, wow, I guess I'm not crazy. I've been thinking that all the time. And then laugh about it. And it's cool. It's very cool.
Let's dial it back a bit. I mean, what was that first job that you didn't like? Do you remember?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I went to school for marketing because, you know, my family. Everyone wants us, you know, go to college. Got to go to college. You don't go to college. Oh, my God, your life's going to be horrible. Go to college. You won't even get into heaven if you don't go to college, you know. So I went to college, and I had a job for a company that owned and ran nightclubs. Like, they opened bars and restaurants. So they had, like, 15 properties, you know, and I did all the jobs, the busboy, the bar back, the bartender, the manager. And, I was going through school, and then I managed for the company and was brought on, and it was a lot of fun. But my personality worked well in there, and I got to open up a little bit. But I was doing like 50 hours a week, and I'm like, this is ridiculous.
But in hindsight, it was almost a foreshadowing for you to appear in front of the mic, you know, on stage.
It did help me a great deal. And, you know, bartending is a real – you know, being – waiter or waitress is such a great place to open up and learn how to use your voice and to play with someone a little bit and to, you know, be, you know, one-on-one with them. So when I get up on a stage now and I'm working a crowd, you know, it's almost like being behind the bar, you know, a little bit playing with everyone, knowing everyone, and then, you know, sharing my story. And
And when you speak about Atlantic City, you can't help but think about the entertainers who have performed there, who have performed in Vegas. People will be, I guess, transitioning between these two hotspots.
Right.
Mean, it must have been a whole host of comedians and entertainers in this place where you grew up.
Really, it's amazing. And, you know, we have this, the boardwalk, which, a lot, you know, along the ocean, and it's kind of, you know, popular in the States, the Atlantic City boardwalk. So many people, W.C. Fields, Charlie Chaplin, all these. There's always been
a great history
of entertainment there. So, you know, it's a really cool vibe. So, yeah, and, you know, you're just watching Don Rickles and life is so strange because I watched Rodney, and then later on in life I became friends with Rodney Dangerfield. I was an usher at his funeral. Like, how bizarre is that? Like, I was buddies with Rodney.
Right.
And as a kid, you know, you dream of doing this and then eventually become, you know, friends with a guy like that, you know? He's so funny. This is the Laugh Factory. He's like 80 years old. He goes, hey, Butchie, you know what stinks about being famous at 80? He goes, you can't do anything. He's like, this room is full of beautiful women. I'm 80. He's like, that's like killing myself. He was the funniest guy ever. Oh, my God.
And being in such close proximity to the likes of such legends like Rodney Dangerfield, how much of that stardust rubbed off on you in determining what your own sound and what your own style was?
Well, to have guys like that, like, you know, walk by you like a Seinfeld or like a Chris Rock or someone just to gesture and go, hey, Butch, and you're like, oh, my God, that guy knows my name.
It just helps, right? It just helps.
It gives you confidence. And also you're following them on stage. Well, that's – I use that loosely. You know, you're out there getting crushed by these, you know, – I remember following Dane Cook. I think it was not until like my 9th time following him. I remember I thought –
What year is this?
This is like 02, 03.
Right.
You know, and he was just about – he was exploding.
Yeah.
I mean, the room was jammed at the Laugh Factory. Lines around the block. You know, Rolling Stone magazines there. Will Smith's hanging out. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. MySpace is a big thing.
Oh,
apparently.
MySpace. The owner's there every day. It was like 74 women. And I'm like, whatever. I get, you know. It was crazy, you know. And, yeah, that guy was there every week. We had MySpace parties. So,
yeah.
So L.A. And it was just jammed. And, you know, in your mind, I'm just like, I remember finally getting laughs, starting to get loose. Because you're following Damon Wayans on, and eventually just, you know, hopefully you either become good and make it, or you just disappear and you don't get a spot again.
My mom made me paranoid of being robbed and all that. Single mom, lover, worked her butt off, but we had a sliding glass door in our house, and she used to be like, that's how they're gonna break in. Who? I don't know, whoever comes through. Go to bed in the middle of the night, my mom would wake my brother and I up. Wake up, wake up. What? Sounds like someone's breaking in. Go see what it is. I'm 9. Oh, I wish as an adult I would be there and catch these guys, you know? Wake up in the middle of the night, going for a glass of water, see someone cutting across my lawn to break in, pop like 2 Viagra. Pull some red lipstick across my face, get to the door before them and open it and be like, I've been f***ing waiting for you since I was 9.
More comedy and showbiz banter with Butch Bradley coming up right after this on Finding the Funny, BFM 89.9. It's Finding the Funny with me, Ezra Zide. My guest tonight is Butch Bradley. Now, for a stand-up comedian, there are many working parts at play. Everything from figuring out the punchline and how the joke is conveyed. How physical is your act? What happens when you get heckled? Can you be preachy, funny, or both? All of these considerations even before you get your first laugh. And for Bradley, it's important to get these things right.
It's really, I mean, you take stand-up, which is already, you know, an incredibly difficult thing to do, and then you add a famous person, and then you add, you know, the whole room. Sometimes you're on stage, and a celebrity will walk in the room, and the audience will be screaming so loud, and you're on stage,
yeah.
And you go, wow, someone famous just walked in. And you see the red light go on, and you're like, well, I guess that means I'm over now. Okay, great. Wow. Special me. I was special for a second there. But it builds you. And then to be able to follow and then to have the laughs. And then when you go work other places, it's very easy because you just followed all these killers. And this scene is cool because you have like a guy like Harith who has like really helped set the standard for Malaysian comedy. He's great. He's a classy, nice guy. He's funny. And then you have these new guys who are out there and trying to figure it out, and there really is not much competition here. It's a really special place right now.
It's the Wild Wild West.
It is, and yeah. I tell them, I go, enjoy this. Mm. Enjoy this time that you're all buddies and you're all getting up, you know.
Nobody's stabbing each other in the back yet.
Right, you're all buddies. Everyone's wonderful. You know, enjoy it, because in about 3 years, you know, it's going to really be it's just going to keep exploding in this part of the world. It's really cool.
So tell me about the process of you crafting and writing jokes for your set. Is it something that develops organically in terms of your observations, or is it something that on a Sunday morning after a cup of coffee that you bring out the pencil and some paper?
Yeah, I am a terrible joke writer, but right. I grew up in a family of storytellers. So for me, I will observe and experience something, and then that passion inspires me to want to take it to stage. And I run off the passion as if it's fuel. So if I don't feel it or feel connected to it in a truthful way, I can't – that's like telling a joke to me. I can't. It feels stale, and it feels insulting from me to you because you're an intelligent person. And if you – I like to think when people see me, they go, wait, this really did occur. I can feel it. I can relate. Or this has happened to me, and I know he's telling the truth because this makes sense. So that's how I do it.
There's
you know?
A certain authenticity that you need to believe in yourself before you present it
for
to
me.
Anybody else.
Yeah, for me. And there are some of my genius joke writing friends when I'm getting ready for television – I immediately call them humbling up. Look, I've got like 5 stories and I need help. Can you help me chop these down a little bit and show me the punchy, you know, and they'll punch it up for me. They go, chop that, and you know, here's boom, 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 boom. Because like say for TV, you would have to have about
a solid 5.
4.5. Yeah, 4.5 with laughter. So that you subtract 30 seconds immediately. Hopefully you have that. Yeah, and maybe even less. So you you have to chop that and time that. So you take it and you have a good joke writing buddy watch you and you start to rehearse it and the crowds don't really understand what you're doing. It doesn't look funny. And then eventually it works itself out and you reposition those jokes.
Rhythmically, when you're doing either a 45-minute to an hour set, there's a lot more latitude and control in which you can bounce off the crowd and bounce off the room.
Right.
Is that something that you're more comfortable in?
I love that. I mean, that's like, you know, my favorite place to be. But when you're doing that and you're working really hard over the years and then you do get offered – I mean, doing radio right now is important. That's a beautiful thing for a comic. That one of these comics one day is going to get a call from you and they're going to go, oh, my God, I'm doing radio today. It's serious. It's a big – it's a cool thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, someone has acknowledged you and they want people to know about you. That's huge. So when you get, you know, all the 45 minutes and the hours and all the sets you do are prepping you for those moments when it's game time. So it is nice to do TV and those things and to do them well, hopefully, because you don't get a second shot. That's the thing. You know, you don't really want to tell anyone who's doing that.
Right.
But there's a reality where every time you do it, you have to do well.
You have to nail it.
You have to. There's no other – there's no – you're done. It's it. Bye-bye. That's it. And when you're in L.A. or New York, you have to nail it.
Do you still feel the anxiety to prove yourself and perhaps to, you know, people who have paid money to watch you. I mean, that you need to sort of kill that particular evening. Or can you sort of, do you coast through evenings? Or is there such a feeling when you've done it for so long?
You know what? The only time I get frightened now is if I don't feel nervous. If I feel flat foot, like you know, I'm not in, I try and relate it to going into a game or a sporting event. And, you know, the guy blows a whistle. If I'm like, odds are someone's going to come across the field and knock me out cold. You know, I want to be, you know, and if I'm not, I step away, I listen to a little music, I get my notes out, and I remind myself, this is not an easy job. It's wonderful, but you better get it together because there's going to be smart people in the audience are going to look and go, he doesn't even care that he's here. Mm. You know what? I don't really think this is funny anymore. He's just coasting through. This guy's just like, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da. And then you see someone stand up and walk out. And then you start to sweat and go, oh, my God, I am losing this room. Dear God, you got to move quick, too. But, yeah, I like to do well. I want people – have I not done well? Of course. You are not going to ever be a good comic if you have not eaten it. It's horrible, but you build armor from that, and you will do poorly less from doing poorly a lot.
Apart from sort of the observations that you make, there's a certain physicality about your performance, and I'm wondering if that came in much early on, or is that something that just developed quite naturally for you?
You know, it's weird. One time on stage, I came off stage, and the guys were imitating me, and I go, what are you doing?
Yeah, almost like a parody of
you. Yeah, and I go, what is that? And they go, are you kidding? You do this on stage. I go, I do not. I'm like standing still. They go, no, you make some really crazy physical gestures. So I have guys all the time, they'll be doing that. And I realize, oh, he's doing me.
Right.
But I think like I slide off when I'm connected to the audience. And look, my hand's moving now. My family speaks with their hands. I'm from like an Irish-Italian-American family.
Right.
So everyone speaks with their hands.
Big gestures.
Yeah, and I'm from New Jersey. So they're always like, love talking to strangers. And they stop you and they want to tell you something. You're like, that guy, I don't even know him. He just told me a 10-minute story. But we use our hands and we're big. And it just keeps it comes out when I get on stage. I don't even know how it happens. But it tends to work, thank God.
Do you still get heckled nowadays? I mean, do you know how to sort of preempt or handle that before it even starts?
Yeah, I'm an improvisationally based storyteller. So I'm definitely not your best choice if that's a thought you have. You know, I also grew up in that environment.
Yeah.
You know, I have old aunts in my family who I wouldn't dare heckle.
Yeah.
You know, they taught me the boom, boom, you know, they pull out a revolver and they're like, ting, sit down. Good luck trying to get me, you know. So I'm probably not your best choice. And also because I'm off script, you're not going to throw me.
Right.
And it's really kind of a terrible thing if you see a really amazing comic who is a scripted, he's going A, B, C, D, E, and he's going to kill, and somebody thinks the show's about them, and they throw out a couple of hits, and it kind of throws him off of his line, and you know, and then the other enemy of a comic is not to get caught being angry.
Yeah.
So if we go angry, it's really tough to recover.
It's really remarkable, actually, seeing some of even the top comics, you know, they, when they can't recover and their anger almost overtakes them. I mean, you see the disintegration
of a
performance.
You're caught. It's the magic is gone. You're caught. That's why I would memorize my material, but then I would let it go because I thought, what if, you know? And it's much, much easier for me to recover from any situation if I'm off script. Because I could just dialogue about it, like, wow, that went over great. Oh, I guess you guys just saw the bad side of Butch. Oh, you don't have a bad side? Oh, you're all wonderful people. Yeah, you know, just address it and hopefully recover. Two times I got angry, and one time, and I was new, and I was in Atlantic City on stage at the Tropicana, and it was a very big show for me. And
why was it a big show for
because
you?
Because I'm in Atlantic City. Mm. I'm at the Tropicana. I'm being paid.
Oh, already the trifecta right there.
Right? And I'm on stage and I'm scared and I'm okay. I'm not even good yet. I'm okay. They liked my energy. They thought I was a good host. I was getting a break. So I'm doing pretty well that week. And I see, this is so crazy, an argument out of the corner of my eye between the waitress and a customer. And it's kind of dark. So I'm watching this as I'm speaking. And I see the waitress turn to walk, and I see the lady throw the glass.
No.
Okay? Throw the glass. And then by magic, the waitress bends over to pick something up. The glass flies through the room, hits the wall. Nobody but me sees it. I stop my comedy and go off on this person. I'm like, are you out of your mind? You could have hurt her. But I'm screaming. Right. No, I realized no one had seen this.
Yeah.
I look like a complete nutcase.
You went into the director's commentary right. for something that nobody else saw
no
but you.
Right. So I completely eat it. The room's dead. Even the waitress thinks I'm completely insane. Yeah. And I go, well, I guess I'll bring on your next comic. I go through the curtain. I've already accepted I'm fired. I am fired.
Yep.
I go off. The owner is waiting for me, and he's laughing. He goes, I'm the only other person that saw the glass. So a miracle. And he was laughing. He goes, you were – he goes, it was beautiful. He goes, I was mad until I saw you eat it just now.
Yeah.
He goes, that was the funniest thing I ever saw in my life. So, yeah. So that, it happens. You can't be angry, though, ever.
We spoke about these different elements. I mean, are you looking at your society in the United States? Are you looking at your family, perhaps? Where do you draw most inspiration from?
You know, right now my place is I'm trying – I would love to say something that's important and make you laugh, but not say too much important where I forget that I am the comedian. That's my job.
And you're not a pastor and not a preacher.
Yeah, I'm not here to lecture you. Yeah. I'm not even smart enough to lecture on these issues. But, you know, it's like California. We have a drought in the States where the rest of the country's soaking wet. It's baffling. We're losing – can't we figure out – can we not create a large enough bottle of water to handle this problem? Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Seriously. You know, and the whole race issues and the police and, like, it's just insane. But it's – you know, it does – in the States and around the world, I think – you know, I was just telling Rizal this – we're all the same. Everyone's got brothers and sisters. Everyone's got a mom and a dad. Everyone, you know, has fallen in love or not in love. So, you know, it's nice for me right now to find that other place that connects the whole world. And for me right now as an American traveling internationally, I just try and address myself to them and let them go, you know what? If they like America, cool. If they didn't, maybe they understand it a little bit more and realize we're exactly the same, you know.
It's interesting because comedians are well positioned to be a commentator on all sorts of things, even though
we would like to think so.
Yeah, but there's almost an emergence about that. You can't escape it because there's so much ridiculousness going on in your Facebook timeline escape it.
Oh my God, and it's difficult because you do have to shut off the fatty world. You know, the fat that you have to shut off the Kardashians. You have to just go, oh my, was I really watching that show? And then get your brain to work on the real issues and to see it. And then also to remember, how is it funny? Why is it funny? You know, and you know, but you can get caught up in all that absolute nonsense. And in the States, that stuff distracts you from even thinking. You know, I bet there's a lot of people probably, sadly enough, don't realize there's a drought in California in the States. And it's probably because you're watching the Kardashians, you're having Starbucks every day, and you have a pretty good life. So good that you don't have to realize that there's other things going on in the world. So, you know, but as a comic, you have to step away and listen. And traveling and doing the international shows are awesome because you're learning. So that when I'm in the States and there's a Malaysian in the audience, we connect. And I go, I know KL. And I've been to Singapore, sir, and I love the food there. And, you know, it's important to relate.
More comedy and showbiz banter with Butch Bradley coming up right after this on Finding the Funny, BFM 89.9. Good evening, it's Finding the Funny on the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. Tonight, we're taking a look at the work of Butch Bradley, an energetic comedian from Atlantic City whose television credits include spots on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, HBO, and Comedy Central. His work in comedy and entertainment means always keeping a pulse on what's current and relevant across multiple different time zones. And that means sometimes a lot of travel. But I ask him whether too much travel is necessarily a good thing for his career.
Well, I spent 12 years in Los Angeles, and I've had some success. You know, I've had deals with Courtney Cox, with Will Smith, and, you know, I've done a ton of TV and, you know, spots but, you know, there's a part of you that grows as an entertainer, and when you're offered to go to a special place to perform, it develops your live show. It develops me and gives me confidence. When I come home and I do a theater at home, I'm just that much more seasoned. And I see the career as a long road as opposed to in Los Angeles when I first got there. It's, I got to get on TV. I got to do this. Got to do, oh, my God.
I got to hurry.
I got an audition. Oh, my God. I got to be famous now. I got to get the big money. And then, you know, I realized, wait, I love this job. Rodney toured until he was 80. I'm extremely young in my business. And the age is really an illusion. It's just your voice that has to be proper and to be able to translate the humor and to connect and reach. So the international travel, you can't be out of LA and New York too long.
Ah.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
There's a sort of unspoken rule.
Hey, where were you? Where have you been? I cannot stand that question when a comic throws it at me like, where have you been? Like, well, you're not in. And I'm like, you know what? You're following me tonight. We'll see where I've been. Okay, have a good set, buddy. You know, and that's that competition that these guys don't have here yet, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, Rizal, where have you been? Well, I went to the States. Well, guess what? I'm the new king in town. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when we think about, you know, not being too far away from the LAs and New Yorks, what are the repercussions of being away too long?
It's almost like a restart. You know, I'm a regular at the Laugh Factory, the Comedy Store, and the Improv. I do not take that for granted. I do not walk to that door after being gone for 6 months and assume they're going to know who I am. The owner will, the comics will, but the staff's probably new. And they're like, excuse me, who are you? Hi, Butch Bradley, I'm a regular. I'm a regular. You kind of have to hold your ground still.
Right.
I go, I'm a regular, honestly. Call Jamie in here, call somebody, and I'm going to just go in and get someone for you, okay? Thanks. You kind of have to be – it's like right before rude, because if not, you're not really in L.A., you're really not who you are, and they'll dismiss you. But you have to also be really funny when you get back into that environment.
Well, this is interesting because you have a scenario right now where comics are even more exposed to just a particular physical location because, you know, sets are being recorded on YouTube and
right.
jokes are being
right.
shared on Twitter.
Right.
And, you know, it used to be, I think it was maybe in the 70s where, you know, Letterman has this story about every comic wanting to be at the Comedy Store because the producers of The Tonight Show
had
would be there.
Right.
And does that still exist in the world of comedy? Let's say in the United States. I mean, is there still a ground zero?
Perfect question. Really, the truth is that when I was there from 2000 on, those first 3 years, like I got Martin Short, I did the Martin Short show probably a year in because our audiences were stacked with, you know, Disney, ABC, NBC, CBS, you know, agents.
Every exec.
Everyone. At least 10 people in that room always, once a week, someone's going to float by you and just go, hey, what's your name? And they'll write it down and you're like, wow. You know, I've been watching you for like 3 years. You know, I was thinking about you. You know, I'm now working with, you know, the Craig Ferguson show and I'm with Conan and I'd like to, you know, could you put something together and show me. And those things did. Now it's very difficult to get execs into the comedy clubs. What does draw them still is the celebrity factor and the fact that you know, the actors and actresses, they just got to spin all year waiting for that moment. Stand-ups are up on stage every night.
Yeah.
It still gives them a place to go hobnob, have a drink, and come see us, maybe bump into Dane Cook, maybe see Seinfeld, and then maybe see someone special who's coming up the run. And it does still work. They will still want to see you live anyway if you're prepping for something or if you're showcasing or if they want to see your characters write for casting for movies. You know, Veer, comedian out of India I just work with, he just got to L.A., just got his agent, and I was like, run hard for 3 months. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, you have an agent right now, but it's all an illusion. And 3 months in one day, if you don't pop something, you will not get anyone on the phone. I've had three major agencies. I've been to the Lakers game in a box. I have, you know, been treated like the king. And I've also immediately had that Hollywood weird moment where I could not get my agent on a phone. And I just start laughing. I go, oh, my God, it happened to me. It happened. And then you just get back. As a stand-up, what's cool is you can write a new set and you just get back up and you let the heat build again. You let the heat build again because if you're funny and you have the endurance, you'll get something.
The endurance to clock in 250, 300 dates a year.
Right.
That seems to be coming back almost. It's a retro thing. Well, you know.
It has. You're right.
Yeah, it's come back.
Famous comics have dropped into my ranks and taken money out of my pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's that about? Is that just keeping it fresh or is it just a throwback?
Because, you know, first of all, I think stand-up comedy is that cool. that these guys know it's cool, and even though they're famous and even though they have money, they if you're not up in front of the mic live, you'll lose that ability. You have to get up. There's some weird – it's like mojo. Like yeah. You'll hear comics go, "Yo, I haven't been up in like a week." And you're like, oh, man, yeah. I gotta,
and everybody looks at you weird.
You got to get up. You're like – it's almost like we're afraid like magically you'll just lose your powers. You know, you're – oh, you haven't been up in 2 weeks? Do you think you still have it? I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm afraid. I don't know. I can't remember my material. Slap me across the face quickly. Slap me. I'm losing it.
But because it looks like, you know, people like Seinfeld have that thing. Well, you know, I've got a new – couple new bits.
He's a joke writer, so it is different for him.
Oh, okay. So joke writers and stand-ups have different anxieties and neuroses.
Well, you don't really know Seinfeld, so that's the thing. Mm. We don't know him. Yeah. We don't know him. You know who you know? You know Chappelle. Chappelle will tell you who he is. You know, so it's different for him. He's going to get up and tell you about his life and his day and what he's going through. The joke writers literally have to go, you know, oh, okay, they left it that.
It's the rhythm, right?
Yeah, the rhythm. Yeah, and the cadence, right.
The economy of that joke.
Yeah. So I went to a store, and this guy said, I can't do that. I can't even do that. I can't even pretend. I can't even imitate pretending to do that. It hurts my soul. But, you know, Seinfeld's great at what he does, but the joke writers have to write the jokes and hear it out loud, just as we do. But I think it's more difficult for them.
They searched me 3 times coming here. When you get searched 3 times, you start to lose it. You're like, oh my God, you know what? I think I have some shit in there. Stand back, I don't know what I've been up to. You know what, I don't even want those bags anymore. I'll wear what I have on, thank you. My bags have zippers. This guy had boxes sealed in duct tape. He was good to go. What? I was like, oh, no one's curious about the freaking box? I thought security needed me. I was there. I was like, hey. I've never made a bomb before, but I have a good idea. Duct tape is involved in that shit.
After this, I ask him what it was like to perform on the USO tour in front of American military men and women who are stationed far away from home. It's Finding the Funny, featuring Butch Bradley, BFM 89.9. Good evening, you're listening to Finding the Funny. Now, we've been speaking to Butch Bradley about all things comedy and a whole host of things, but on the list of all of his appearances, television credits, and comedy clubs, the one performance I was curious about was his USO tour. Now, when you think about the USO tour, names like Bob Hope, Louis C.K., Jerry Seinfeld, they've all done it. And the purpose of these USO tours is, of course, to boost the morale of the American men and women in uniform who are stationed in conflict areas across the world. You perform on the USO tour in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah, crazy. I know. And I still do. Yeah, it's, you know, crazy.
You know, comedians who do that, it's a very interesting selection of comedians.
I'm actually in the CIA. All right, I said it. I'm the funniest agent.
And tell me, like, is that a different crowd? Is it a difficult crowd? Or is it just because it's not a dark room anymore, you're out in the desert? I mean, what's that like?
All right, so it's funny because it was a lesson. I've been to Afghanistan 6 times, Iraq twice, a ton of, you know, all the other USO places that are safe. You know, Bosnia, Kosovo, Japan, Korea,
right.
Guam, Guantanamo. I've been to Guantanamo 3 times. So, yeah, I'm working on a lot of moral issues where comedy fits in these places. So, you know, but the first – I'm very American. So my first time to Baghdad, I land. I have my hands over my head with, my fingers like, yeah, someone take a picture.
Yeah.
Woohoo, I'm in Iraq, yeah. Yeah. And then after experiencing the reality of war and the horrors of it, and then I'm like embarrassed that I did that, you know, because you're at home in the States watching the war on TV. It loses the reality, you know, and now I understood. The shows are incredible. These people are husbands and wives, you know, sons and daughters. They barely talk to anyone at home. It's very stressful taking rocket attacks constantly, or the threat, just the threat, the invisible threat of death and being away from your family and all. So these shows are truthfully – so needed. The shows are incredible. They love it. And that's where traveling is a big deal, because people will line up.
Yeah.
Like 300 people will line up to say hi to me. And I'll go, oh, so you're from Cincinnati. Oh, my God, what a dumpy town you're from. And we'll joke and play. And so, yeah, those shows are pretty incredible.
But
yeah.
With the troops, though, they – I mean – it's different in that sense, because as a comic, you actually want them to laugh.
Yeah,
Of course, you want every other audience to laugh, but there's a different desire to want these troops to feel like, well, this is going to be a great 20 minutes for them.
And that's why only very good comics, I humbly say that, should be in those scenarios, because they don't want – first of all, they don't want to be lectured about politics.
Right, and it's you very awkward,
every soldier
right?
in every military in every country in the world – has his moments where he's like, I don't know if this is really what I want to do.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And then everyone tells the soldier, well, this is – no. He's a soldier. He's – you know, let's let them make – you know, I don't lecture them, and I'm very honest. I tell them I'm terrified. I just got out of a Black Hawk. I just did a convoy. I was almost killed. I don't know what I'm doing here. And the desert's hot, and that's probably the problem. Everyone's cranky because it's hot here.
It's hot.
If we pump some air conditioning in, maybe people will come out of this nonsense. And someone will go, what? I was trying to blow you up? Oh, my God. I was just hot. I'm sorry. Let's all go home. You know, it's, you know, I tell them the truth. I tell them, you know, there's forward operating bases with speed bumps on them. Speed bumps. Where's the logic in this guy can't drive as fast as he wants right now? Where can you know, I go, you so there's those are the things I play with. The food and you know, we had steak and lobster one day. I could not believe it. And the general, one major high level general comes in. They tell me, do not talk to him. I'm from New Jersey. I am definitely talking to the general. Everyone in there is frozen because the general's there. And I go, the general, see a round of applause. I go, sir, thank you so much for coming in. He's already does not want to talk to me. I go, sir, today was steak and lobster day. I go, amazing. I go, but you gave us plastic silverware. Do you know I never actually got to finish my meal because everything kept breaking? I go, you trust me with an M4, but you don't trust me with silverware? Place goes nuts. He goes, very funny. I'm out of here.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, you got to be honest. You got to address the moments and just think these people have families and, you know – I don't know. It's a human weird thing to do comedy in those environments, but I feel very lucky and very honored to have been there. So, you know, and I got to tell jokes. So after 9/11, every American was like, what do I do? Do I go join the military? What are we doing? And, you know, I got to go tell jokes. And
you found your pocket in that,
In
that cycle.
Yeah. So.
So you've done just the variety of things that we've spoken about in the past half an hour or so. You've done so many different things. And so what excites you and where do you think in the next decade or so, where do you want to spend most of your time doing that particular thing?
Ultimately, my favorite place beyond stage is being on set in a studio filming something. It is just so incredibly cool to get a call from your trailer and to go get on set and, you know, and film. And, I did this thing called Sullivan and Sons, an American comedy about an Asian American whose father was Irish. And so he's half, you know, he's half Asian, he's half Irish. It's in a bar setting. And I ended up with like four buddies who are comedians. It was just so fun, so cool. Your friends are doing – it's a successful, amazing thing. And yeah. We're looking at each other like
– what's going on?
How did we get here? Oh, my – I remember working in Iowa with you. I remember being, you know, chased out of a nightclub with you. You know, like all our crazy stories. And here we are, you know, acting and paid well. And just – it's a creative, beautiful place. So, yeah, I'm always at that, looking for that. Right now I'm doing some writing. Believe it or not, I'm writing for a Russian director who has a movie deal. So I don't know how these people find you, but I'm very thankful for it. Making money, translating his movie.
It also sounds scary at the same time.
It is so weird, right? It's just so weird. And, you know, I'm a typical comic, so I get this call, and they're like, this Russian director likes you. I'm like, right. Uh-huh. Who is this? No Russian director wants me to write for him. So it's just me that I'm writing for him. I'm still auditioning. But ultimately is to stay the course, to be a funny comic, to relate, and to have that power that when I'm in New York or L.A. or in Las Vegas, like I'm headlining the MGM Grand this New Year's Eve. That is a gigantic gig for me.
Yeah.
And you get booked well in advance. So when you get that call, it's still a shocking thing for me. Like, I have the MGM this year. That's incredible. And a lot of my buddies are going to like it, and a lot are going to hate it because I just took New Year's Eve away from a lot of guys who hope to get that. Not to just headline in Vegas, but to close a New Year's Eve show for the biggest and, like, one of the hottest. It's a cool thing. So I don't know where my career is going. I do know that the stage has answered every problem I've ever had and that I want to keep that and respect it and see where it takes me, continue to audition, continue to write. right? And, you know, just to get up and kill.
Almost like the stage is the gym.
It is the gym.
And you can't go wrong as long as you keep going back to the gym.
Exactly. It is the gym. You have to get up. That's why these wealthy, famous comics, if they go to stage a couple times and then they go to set to do something, you know, comedically or serious acting, it's much easier after stand-up.
I don't like I believe in ghosts. I watch scary movies. I just don't like when the kid ghost shows up. The Grudge was pretty good. Now, if you haven't seen The Grudge, there's a little Asian dude like this big. I think he's from this part of the world. He's a little Roselle. He just goes, I went, movie off. I don't know what means. Whoa. Who was the genius that wrote that? Right? Producers read it and they went, what is... this is silly. No, sir, it's a little Asian dude this big. He's going to go... All right, we're going to make this movie. We're going to make this movie. I'm not going to watch it, but we're going to make this movie. The Ring. Have you seen The Ring? Little girl, long black hair, tried to come out of my TV. Movie off. Then I yanked the plug, turned the TV around, put it against a wall. I figured if she returns, she'll hit her head, change directions. I don't even know what she's upset at. You have hair in your mouth? That's not my problem. Go find and work your shit out. First, you're fine with your scary movie, right? But then you begin to hear things. I don't even know why I do this to myself. This is bull. And contrary to what every woman in this room thinks, men are not heroic. In the middle of the night, when we hear a noise, we're not like, ready the horses! Bring me my shield! When a man hears a noise in the middle of the night, it's more like this. Take whatever you want. Just don't wake her up. Hey, you guys have been amazing. My name is Butch Bradley. Thank you, Malaysia, so much. What a beautiful country. What an amazing place.
And folks, that's all the time we have for Finding the Funny featuring Butch Bradley. He recently performed at the Crack House Comedy Club right here in Kuala Lumpur. Our thanks to them. Head over to their website for the best and latest international and local acts performing right here in KL. That's crackhousecomedy.asia. If you missed any part of this program, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Share us what you thought about the show at feedback@bfm.my. I'm Ezra Zaid. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.